the key issue here is that up till fairly recently, parents thought of television as an innocuous pastime, if not a convenient babysitter, and never really were terribly concerned about presumed negative effects.
Television, films, and the American viewer, next on Soundings.
The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Soundings is pleased to present the concluding segment of a discussion about television and films and their effects on American viewers in a conversation with Professors Eli Rubenstein and Thomas Cripps. Rubenstein is research professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina. He was assistant director of the National Institute of Mental Health and served as co-editor of the Surgeon General's report on television and social behavior. Cripps is a scholar at the National Humanities Center and professor of history at Morgan State University, where he specializes in film history and criticism. The discussion begins with Professor Rubenstein's comments about the various national lobbying groups and coalitions attempting to influence television programming.
What kinds of programs would these groups, such as this coalition that you've mentioned, what kinds of programs are they advocating? Or, as you say, is this the problem, that they're not advocating a substitute?
That is the problem. What they're doing is they are monitoring programs to identify those that are most violent. They have indeed identified a whole series.
For instance?
Well, this month's list shows high-violence programs. Number one is Riker. Number two is Walking Tall. Number three is Foul Play. Number four is Heart to Heart, etc. Now,
so these are movies as well as television series that
they
appear on TV.
They are movies as well as television series, and they also... There's an interesting extension to this issue, which troubles me. I'll quote from this latest newsletter. They say that the clear link between media violence and real violence in the case of the film Taxi Driver and John Hinckley's attempt to kill the president draws public attention and gets press coverage because the intended victim is a public figure. But such a connection is not that rare. There are bank robberies, murders, rapes, muggings, and other crimes committed against ordinary people every day that are related in some way to violence on television. Now, my concern with that statement is that it really goes far beyond what the research shows us. We don't have a connection between murders, rapes, muggings, and crimes, and violence on television.
Do we have any connections
yes,
at all?
Yes, we do. There's no question that we have a connection, and the connection is as follows. If you take two groups of individuals, one of whom watches a great deal of TV violence, and another group does not, the evidence is quite clear, as unequivocal as social science evidence can be, that the first group that watched a lot of TV violence is much more likely to engage in aggressive behavior than the second group is. Now, you cannot scientifically draw from that conclusion the fact that one individual at a particular time will engage in one particular kind of crime. In fact, there's an interesting case of murder in Florida in which that very connection was tried to be made and failed. The lawyer in Florida, a young adolescent killed an older woman, and the lawyer said that this young man was suffering from temporary insanity because of watching a great deal of TV violence, and that in effect violence on television is what caused him to commit this murder. The jury found otherwise. In fact, the
why specifically did the jury find otherwise?
Well, two reasons. Legally, I'm not a legal expert. Legally, the judge threw out the possibility of citing the research evidence to support the defendant's claim because there is no research on the books that demonstrates that a person, having watched X amount of television, will commit Y or Z type of crime. You can make an analogy, for example, between this situation and perhaps something that's easier to see. There is no question that the evidence on smoking indicates that statistically, the more you smoke, the more you are likely to get lung cancer or heart disease. But one cannot select an individual and say to them, you have been smoking for 33 years. On February 27th, 1982, you are going to die of heart disease or lung cancer. You cannot make that connection. But statistically, you can. That's what keeps the insurance companies going. It's actuarial bases, but not an individual case. Now, I think, unfortunately, what groups like this National Coalition are trying to do, and I think incorrectly, is to make this individual connection. Now, the reason I think it's unfortunate is because there is strong research evidence to suggest that TV violence should be reduced. And I think that the industry, in a curious way, is let off the hook by contentions such as this, as well-meaning as they may be, that an individual case has in fact occurred because of TV violence.
I want to broaden the focus of our discussion somewhat. Professor Cripps, why is it that the movies don't get accused of having such a social impact as television?
No, movies escape responsibility these days because of their changed status. They used to serve the function that television now serves. A movie critic once said, television has replaced the B-movie. And there's a lot of truth in this, in that researchers in the 1930s especially felt exactly about movies as researchers in similar fields today feel about television.
So what are we going through a phase here?
No, it's not a phase. It's something permanent. In the 30s also, there were at least as many groups concerned with film as are concerned with television today, such as the NCTV group and Action for Children's Television and so on. The difference is that movie people now know precisely who their audience is. It's a group of people between the ages of roughly 15 and 25. Last 5 years they've gone down slightly to perhaps to 13 to 25. And that's who buys the tickets, and practically no one else. All right, what we end up talking about is that movies do not affect a vast sea of an aggregate of people, undifferentiated, but rather a small group that we tend to assume is now prepared to deal with the movies.
Will this change with the advent of what has come to be called narrowcasting, the identification and seeking out of specific audience segments by cable television people and the people who market movies for play at home, that kind of thing?
Well, historians don't like to talk about the future, but if we look at the possibilities for technology, the movie people, many of them anyway, seem prepared for the end of theater movie going. They assume that by the end of the century or sooner, most movie viewing will be done through narrow casting, that is, cable television or cassettes or some other form of communication will negate the need to go out of the house to see a film.
Is that going to change the content any?
It won't change the content as much as it will make it even easier to reach the audience. Each moviegoer will know a filmmaker whose work he'll watch out for, and each filmmaker will know a segment of the audience to seek out. There'll be a line of communication almost as precise as a telephone. New technology could easily wipe out network television as we know it and nullify all of our problems that
all
we're so concerned with today.
I don't know that we have hard data on that. I think what we do know is that the more choice there is, we haven't used this term before, but I think one of the objectives, one of the positive objectives is to provide greater diversity of programming. And I think that's the objective, that if this new technology provides increasing diversity, I think it will be good. To the extent that it provides opportunity for narrowing the diversity by selection, it may be bad. I really don't think, however, trying to answer your questions responsibly, I don't think that narrow casting or the increasing technology, so far as children are concerned, decreases the need for parental concern and parental involvement. I think the key issue here is that up till fairly recently, parents thought of television as an innocuous pastime, if not a convenient babysitter, and never really were terribly concerned about presumed negative effects. And I think that parents really have to understand, granted the point that you make that they don't all do so, but I think they need to be alerted to the fact they have to be more concerned about the time spent with television.
How is it, question for both Professor Cripps and Professor Rubenstein, how is it that these media, films, and television act as cultural indicators?
Well, this is a problem for students of popular culture in that they're constantly looking for a model through which to study this phenomenon. And a sociologist named David Berger has tried to get away from the notion of whether popular culture reflects society or changes it by looking at it from the point of view of the marketplace. That is, in effect, everything that's electronic should be seen as a almost like a folk culture, in the sense that a few people creating for a market in effect try to be that market's voice, almost as though to create for the market what it would have created for itself. Now, obviously, that's not a perfectly democratic line of communication. The feedback is not very efficient. But his point is that in measuring the phenomena of popular culture, that it should be possible to program to any targeted audience and therefore create a democratic society, a society of communication. But that the instrument through which this has to take place is the breakdown of monopoly. That is, as long as you have complete access to production by record companies, independent record companies, independent filmmaking companies, or television broadcasters, then you're programming more truly to what the audience wants. But the closer you get to monopoly, let's say having only three networks, for an example, the more likely it will be a kind of monolithic, perhaps even authoritarian, system of communication. But now Marxist critics are looking at popular culture in a much more sophisticated way, with an idea of studying it as a system of marketing, and therefore marketing of ideas.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
This edition of Soundings deals with television and films and their effects on American viewers in a conversation with Professors Eli Rubenstein and Thomas Cripps. Rubenstein is a research psychologist at the University of North Carolina and served as co-editor of the Surgeon General's report on television and social behavior. Cripps is a scholar at the National Humanities Center on leave from Morgan State University, where his specialty is film history and criticism.
Professor Rubenstein, television is more pervasive than films, as Dr. Cripps has pointed out. How is TV a cultural indicator?
Okay. I'd like to take a crack at that question in a slightly different way. there is, in fact, one of the researchers in the field who uses that term, cultural indicator, as part of his total research perspective on television and its impact on the audience. And this is a man named George Gerbner, who's dean of the School of Communications in the University of Pennsylvania. And his thesis is that the content of television, as it's now presented, in effect is a communication to the audience about a world that television has created, which may or may not be similar to the real world. Now, he's got a lot of data which indicates that while there are some similarities, there are very, very many differences between the television world and the real world. Heavy viewers tend to see the real world in the light of the television world.
That For instance, the Peter Sellers character in Bean there.
Exactly. And so the sexual stereotypes I mentioned earlier, or the fact that various people conclude whatever they're doing within the framework of time that a program takes, all of these subtle and not so subtle attributes of television programming form the basis for an evaluation of the real world based on that. Now, unfortunately, to the extent that an individual has less contact with the real world, the more he or she is likely to be influenced by the television world and assume that is the real world. And so you have a serious problem here where I think television in that connection does not reflect the real world. It distorts the real world, and people tend to believe that distortion. Dr. Gerbner's main concern is that in toto, the television world is essentially a mean world. People get hurt, there's a lot of violence, there's a lot of destruction. Dramatic things happen, and many of them are bad. And people who watch a lot of television tend to believe the mean world. They think there are many more accidents. They think there are many more murders. They think there are many more negative things happening in the real world than is actually the case. Many of them tend, therefore, to be concerned about and afraid of the real world as they see it reflected in the television world.
I would like to ask both of you about regulation. Professor Cripps, have the movies sort of come of age? Are we past the point of regulating films? A lot of people seem to think that the rating codes are really kind of a joke, that you go to the movies and you see all kinds of little kids watching R-rated films. And then, Professor Rubenstein, I'd like you to comment on that with regard to television.
Well, I think the rating system itself is not really an issue. It'll constantly be quarreled over. But the important thing is that movies have grown toward this narrow audience that we talked about earlier, the age of 15 to 25. And therefore, no group seriously thinks any longer that it has a duty to regulate for this almost adult, entirely adult audience. But television, I think, will be permanently a different matter because of its connection with the home, first of all, but also because television from its birth has been regulated by law, and no one can imagine a day when it won't be regulated by law. Whereas films, by the late 1930s, were insisting that they were no longer entertainment, that they were a medium of communication and journalism and instruction, and therefore should have First Amendment rights. And that right was won in numerous court decisions. So films, because of the audience, the size of the audience, and their history, and a history borne out in court decisions, will be relatively less regulated from now on. And television, because of its history, that is founded in the law, Federal Communications Act of 1934, I think, and its history as a family medium, will always be regulated.
Professor Rubenstein, this sounds, Dr. Cripps's remarks sound as though we're going to have more regulation.
Well, I think I would disagree with that for two reasons. While there's no question that there's more regulation on television than in the films, I think that the implication that that regulation carries over into programming per se is perhaps a little overstated. A good example, the mid-1970s, the so-called family viewing time was initiated, and that was supposed to have been by voluntary collaboration among the three networks that they would set aside in the early evening programming which was more suitable for the family and hold more adult-type programming for after 9 or 10 o'clock. In California, the family viewing time, the Supreme Court in California, knocked down that particular arrangement on the presumption that they had been pressured into doing so by the Federal Communications Commission, and that therefore it was inappropriate.
The networks, you mean?
The networks were pressured by the Federal Communications Commission, and therefore was inappropriate for them to engage in this kind of endeavor, because the FCC was not supposed to be in charge of programming. In fact, the networks have continued on a kind of voluntary basis to maintain a family viewing time. So I think that I agree that there's more regulation, but I think you need to realize it's probably not going to be as true as a regulatory procedure, perhaps as a threat of regulation, but not as an actual regulation, insofar as programming is concerned. I think there's an insoluble problem here. I think that even though I have said earlier I'm in favor of the collaborative versus the adversary approach, I think, in fact, there are fundamental different philosophies and objectives here that are not going to be totally reconciled. I think they can be reconciled more than they are now, in just the same way as large corporations do things for enlightened self-interest, which aren't immediately profit-oriented, but in the long run are. I think the networks should be doing the same thing, and let me give you just one example of what I have in mind. I think the networks have been grossly negligent in the past 10 years or more in putting some of their monies into their own research into what it is that audiences do or do not do in terms of effects of programming. There was a very interesting proposal made in England a couple of years ago that the BBC literally engage in more in-house research on these kinds of questions. The television industry is now a $10 billion a year industry. Over the past 10 years, they have probably invested a grand total, and I think this is a generous estimate, of $10 million in social science research other than audience count and sheer marketing research, which they, of course, do a great deal of.
In other words, a fraction of...
An infinitesimal fraction, 0.01%, is devoted to this kind of endeavor. Now, I think that even though they may believe what they don't know can't hurt them, I think in the long run they'd have been much better off having spent a lot more money trying to anticipate some of the things that some of the researchers have been finding out. Next year, or towards the end of this year, there will be a major report coming out, which is a 10-year update of the Surgeon General's report that I mentioned earlier. The major conclusion of which, to be very general, since the conclusion has not been written as yet, but I think the major conclusion will be that the past 10 years have shown that television's effect has been much more extensive than we originally thought. It's not just TV violence. In fact, television is a significant socializing agent of child development. Now, what that will create in the way of further pressures on the industry, I don't know. Perhaps none, perhaps some. It would have been very useful if the industry had been involved in some of that research, so they would know before the fact what they need to be concerned about prepared for or ready to do. I think that both of these things are important for them. There may be some things they need to avoid. There ought to be some things they need to do. I want to make one other point, though, that's terribly important in all of this. And again, an issue that they should have known before. If you talk to some of the television network executives, they will tell you that all of their programming is pro-social because the consequences are almost invariably the bad get punished and the good get rewarded. So even when they show violence, the program resolution at the end is in favor of good.
But what's being objected to is the getting to that conclusion.
Well, that's something to object to. The other is that with young children, earlier than age 8, who watch some of these programs, they don't relate the act to the consequences. So they don't see the moral ending the way adults do. Now, it is therefore important to know that fundamental aspect of research. It is also terribly important to know that children of that age have a limited capacity to make any kinds of connections in a temporal sequence of programming. They may see incidents in isolation rather than be able to take in the entire sequence of events. So these are just some simple things that I think they should be paying more attention to. And there may well be things that, even at this moment in time, that we don't know that we ought to be knowing about programming and how it affects the viewer. Now, I don't want to criticize them without also complimenting them for some of the things they're doing well. I think children's programming with the specials that are now being produced are a step in the right direction. One of the networks, for example, has in its public service announcements been saying not all programming is for all individuals. Parents should watch what their children are watching. Parents should watch with their children. These are all steps in the right direction. I would hope that what the networks would do would be to engage in what is now a very active area of research, that is the teaching of critical television viewing skills. Television, if it is not a completely innocuous activity, ought to be approached from the standpoint of how do you learn to get the most out of what you see? How is a program put together? What does it mean that the camera pans in and out? There are so many nonverbal aspects of communication on a television program that we take for granted that children may not know. Fast cuts, all sorts of things that children ought to be alerted to. The inevitable exaggeration of commercials. Children should be protected against the inherent deception in an advertisement because of it being condensed into a 30-second spot or a 1-minute spot. And so there are almost endless aspects of teaching critical television viewing skills that I would hope the networks would spend more time in being involved in.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Please join me this week for the Center's radio program, Soundings, when the topic will be the impact of television and films on American culture, and particularly upon younger viewers.
Two experts, a psychologist from the University of North Carolina and a film and television historian from Morgan State University, will provide some insights. I hope you'll be listening for Soundings.